oh my God, you love it too? Let's nerd out together.
We're best friends now.
We're best friends. Oh, we're totally best friends.
Hi, and welcome to Literary Hype Podcast. I am Stephanie, your literary hype woman, and today we have an icon on the show. I really don't know how I landed this one. It's magic. It's pure magic at this point. John Scalzi is the author of so many very popular and beloved sci-fi books, and his new one is called When the Moon Hits Your Eye, which, yes, that is cheese. And the whole premise of this book is that the moon is turned to cheese. So you know you're in for a good time when that's what this guy is writing. So without any further ado, here's my conversation with John Scalzi from C2E2 in Chicago. Welcome to Literary Hype. It's so exciting to have you on to talk about your brand new book, When the Moon Hits Your Eye.
Thank you. It's good to be here at C2E2.
C2E2 is a good time.
It is a good time. I've been doing a lot of conventions recently. I just did a book tour, and so I was here. I was at Awesome Con. I'll be at LA Times Festival of Books. I'm basically everywhere across the country.
But we learned a lot about you here at C2E2 this week. First and foremost, we got to talk about you're a DJ.
Yeah.
And TJ Klune learned this during his spotlight panel where he flipped it back to you.
Right.
So talk a little bit about how you got into DJing.
So here's the thing, which is I used to be a music critic, and so would do write-ups and go to concerts and do all this sort of stuff. In fact, here in Chicago, way back when, and we're talking like the 90s, I used to write for New City Magazine and for the Sun-Times doing music stuff. And so many years later, I was at a convention where I was a guest of honor, and they had a DJ doing an 80s dance. And the thing was, the DJ was 19 years old, so he hadn't been alive, you know, in the 80s. And so he was playing what someone who from the 80s knows is all the off-brand 80s songs, right? Like, he was just like, well, this was a hit at one time, we'll put that on. And I was just sitting there, because I like to dance. I took 2 years of jazz and modern. You wouldn't know it by looking at me, but, and that's how I met my wife. She saw me dancing, and it was like, that man is the man I want. So I've always really enjoyed dancing. And I was not having fun at that dance, and so I was very grumpy. I was like, what's wrong with it? I could do a better job being a DJ than this guy. And they're like, okay, come back next year and do it. I'm like, well, I will show you. And I came back the next year and I DJed. And of course, it was a spectacular time because I was actually alive for the 80s and it was an 80s dance. And then ever since then, science fiction conventions and other sort of nerd places have been like, will you DJ for us? And I think, like I said at the panel, I think there's two reasons. One, because I'm going to be there anyway. And so they think it's kind of fun. And the other thing is there's something really weird and wacky about having a Hugo-winning DJ. Like, the two don't really seem to go together.
It's a hilarious combination.
It is a hilarious combination. But I do quite a lot of gigs. I did one on the Joko Cruise where I did a nerd prom. So, you know, played a lot of songs there. At Capricorn, which is another convention here in Chicago, I was the DJ. And so, yeah, I just kind of fell into it and really enjoyed it. And the good news is that no matter where I am, I always have music to dance to with my wife.
So you go to a lot of conventions. What are your favorite fandoms?
It's hard to say. I mean, I mean, general science fiction and fantasy fandom is just, you know, wide and kind of wild. And I came into it from the outside, because I used to be a journalist. I didn't do conventions. My wife, who is definitely not a nerd, went to a convention before I ever did. She went to a X-Files convention back in the 1990s. So my very first convention wasn't until I actually had sold Old Man's War, and I was like, well, I need to go to a convention and find out who my people are. And it was very interesting, and for someone who had always been on kind of not knowing anything about it, was very eye-opening. And so it's hard for me to really sort of differentiate the fandoms, because I don't feel like I kind of grew up with them. And I think that the thing is that all of the fandoms, whether you're like, you know, whether you're a brown shirt or, you know, not a brown shirt, a brown coat, or a Star Wars fan or a Star Trek fan or any of that sort of stuff, what it all comes down to is just not only a love for the genre and for that particular property, but a desire to really want to share that with other people and just be super enthusiastic. And I've always said that's kind of the difference between a nerd and a hipster. Like, a hipster loves something, and then when it becomes popular, they're like, you weren't here from the beginning. Whereas a nerd, when they love something, are like, oh my God, you love it too? Let's nerd out together.
We're best friends now.
We're totally best friends, right? And so that is something that I really love. So it's hard for me to say that one is better or I enjoy one more, because I think the hallmarks of what nerddom are, that enthusiasm, that deep lore, all of that is kind of universal.
I read something online that Old Man's War is partially inspired by Starship Troopers.
Yes.
And they're here this weekend.
The Starship Trooper people? Yes, I did notice that the film people were there. You know, part of me was like, go see them. Go say hello. But they have no idea who I am. So, you know, come up there like, I wrote a book too. And they're like, okay, good for you. All right, thank you. Thank you. Here's your signature. You know, so you have to be careful. The idea that one pocket of fame is necessarily going to translate into another pocket of fame is not always the case. Although I did have one time, there was one time where I was at Emerald City Comic Con, which is in Seattle, and I was there as a guest. And somebody from the convention was like, we have someone who wants to meet you. And I was like, okay. And they're like, okay, but you'll have to go up to him because he's busy signing stuff. And I'm like, okay. And so we go up to where the, you know, autographs are, and I'm led to Alan Tudyk, right?
And cool.
And they cut me into line, and so immediately everybody in line's pissed at me, right? Because like, what is this guy? Why is he cutting into line and all this? And I look back to them. I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't know. And so he's in the mode, right? And he signs the next person. He looks up at me. He's like, huh? And I'm like, I'm John Scalzi. And he's like, huh? And I was like, you asked for me. And then he goes, and he like gets up and he runs to right behind him where he's got his backpack. He unzips it and there's this tattered Old Man's War. He's like, I just, this and with just, it's so, wait, would you sign it? And I'm like, why, of course. Yes, I will. How's your convention going? Blah, blah, blah. And I sign it and I do all this sort of stuff. And of course, everybody's watching like, what the hell is going on here? And then I say, so I'll see you some other time. Cool. All right. Thank you, Alan Tudyk. Goodbye. And I walk away and it's like, you know, that thing where people walk away and an explosion happens behind them. I felt very much like that.
Did you also feel like that when Tom Hanks told the waiter all about you?
That was fun. It's ridiculous. The thing is that every time a movie with Tom Hanks comes on, my wife ribs me about it, right? Because he's a fan. He sent me fan mail. So every time he's like on in a movie, she's like, look, it's your pal Tom. It's your fan Tom. And she's, you know, giving me, you know, a hard time about it. But yes, he like knows who I am and I exist. And every once in a while, I'll send him an email. And every once in a while, he'll send me an email. And I'm just like, oh, I know Tom Hanks. We're pals. Whoa.
What's it like for you to know that celebrities are fans of yours?
It's weird. It's very, very weird. Like every other human, I don't necessarily always believe that celebrities are real people, you know. And I get a little bit of that, too, because as some people's favorite writer, they're like, you exist on this other plane. I was like, no, I assure you that I don't. I need a Snickers bar right now because I'm getting hangry. I am a human.
And Nobody wants a hangry writer.
No one wants a hangry writer. It's like, I'm going to rant now. But no, it is very much the same sort of thing. The recognition that, no, in fact, celebrities are, in fact, normal people, except they tend to be richer and prettier, right? But yeah, no, every once in a while, you'll have that thing where you're like, oh, how cool is this? Tom Hanks knows I exist. Or I have like friends who are musicians. Like I grew up in the 80s, so there was a band called Yaz, or Yazoo if you were from the UK. And their lead singer, Alison Moyet, was like a foundational singer for me. And we met, we chatted on social media, and I got to meet her. And that was like one of the few times I was genuinely starstruck. And her And her manager was always like, you're just going to have 5 minutes and it's going to be a meeting. And I'm like, I totally get this. In my own little sphere, I do this all the time. I get it. I'm not going to be a problem. And then I go and meet her, and the first thing she does is she gives me a great big hug, and she's like, we have to take a picture together. My husband and daughter are such huge fans of yours. I want them to be jealous. And I'm like, yes.
So you touched on your career as a journalist, which is something we both have in common.
Right.
As being in news for eons. So what did you learn about writing fiction from your time as a journalist?
This is actually something I tell people all the time because they think that they're two completely separate fields, but they're not. One, a lot of times when you're writing fiction, what you're doing is sort of reportage, right? You are describing the scene. You are saying what is relevant, who, what, when, where, why, all of those sorts of things that you're supposed to do in journalism. And so for me, it made it really easy because I could set the scene like I'm telling, making a news article out of it. The other thing is that, and this has been a real competitive advantage, when you're a journalist, you have to hit your deadline.
There's no missing it.
It doesn't matter if you're sick, if you're feeling bad, if you're not, the muse, it doesn't matter. It's 3 o'clock. Where's your article? Because if you don't get it done, there's a hole in the newspaper and it's your fault, right? And they'll fill it with AP or something like that. But ultimately, like, no, that was your slot and you did not fill the news hole. So it didn't matter whether it was bad, whether it was good, whether it was indifferent, whether it was the most brilliant thing you've ever written, it has to be in. And that thing of having that relationship with deadlines has been hugely important for my career, because one of the things that they don't worry about me is whether or not I'm going to hit the deadline. They're like, this is when you need to have it in. I may have it in at 7 a.m. that morning, but it will be in. Or if it's not in, like I was for the new book that I just finished writing in January, I was 3 weeks late. But I had a cat with a urinary tract infection and I had a relative die. So they're like, you know what? Take your time. Right. So that was the thing. But hitting deadlines is actually hugely important because apparently, I didn't know this, a lot of creative people have a hard time with deadlines. And I'm like, no, you have to get it in or a copy editor will strangle you.
That is like definitely a war in my head as a journalist, but also as a creative of like,
yeah,
I have the I can't do anything until I have a deadline, but I want to do things, but I can't because there's no deadline.
Right. If there's not a deadline, then why am I even doing it at all? Because I have all the time in the world until the deadline. And that still works. I mean, like the deadline, 80% of the work gets done near a deadline, and 20% of the work expands all the rest of the time.
So. Due tomorrow.
Due tomorrow. You don't have a choice. There was one time where I had a book that was coming out, or that I was trying to finish, and I looked at the date, and it was, that book is due on the 18th of June. It is the 4th of June. So I wrote an entire novel in 2 weeks because I was like, there's a deadline. And I didn't tell anybody that I had done it until the book came out. It hit the New York Times bestseller list, and it got starred reviews in the trades. Because when that all happened, I was like, okay, they didn't catch me. They didn't know. Now I can say I did it.
This sounds so real. Like, I feel like a little attacked in this moment.
Yes.
But it is so important, like the ADHD.
Yeah, yeah.
You need that time. You need the nuance. You need the incentive in order to do
that. You need somebody to say, no, it actually has to be in. Because if it's open-ended, it will never get done. Because there are so many things else you could do. There are video games. There are social media.
So many books to read.
I have 3 cats. They are endlessly entertaining. Right, exactly. But no, you give me a deadline, I'm like, okay, now I can start my process because I know when my process needs to end.
Do you feel like your process changes when you are on a tighter deadline, or do you stick to the same kind of routine that you do?
I mean, my process is just pull it out of my backside. So that never changes. It's just how quickly I do it or not.
Your books are humorous.
Yes.
Very often. So the first time I saw When the Moon Hits Your Eye was when you were sitting in line at New York Comic Con.
Right.
Doing a signing. And you were sitting there reading it and still laughing.
Yeah.
So what about this book makes you giggle, even after you've written it and gone through all these trenches with it?
Well, the first thing you have to understand is that writers have amnesia. So, like, you turn in a book and then you immediately forget about it, right? Because it's just that short-term memory dump of getting everything done is gone, and your brain just kind of wipes out. You get the copy edit, and when I look at the copy edit, I only look at where the specific copy edits are, so I don't particularly read it again. And then later on, I'll pick up a book of mine, and I'll like read a passage or I'll read a chapter, and I'm like, I don't know how I did that. But it seems to be working. So the jokes and stuff like that, I don't want to say the jokes are brand new to me, but it is being able to look at it with fresh eyes because your brain has been like, I don't want to think about this thing anymore. I thought about that for 6 months straight. Purge out the, you know, out the airlock. And so, yeah, I will pick up stuff and I'll be like, oh, no, that is actually funny. What a clever man who wrote that. Good for him. But there's the other aspect of it that I am a real believer that as a writer, if I think something is funny, then there's a better chance you're going to think it's funny. If I write something that makes me cry, then there's a better chance that it will make you cry as well. So I am very reactive to my own writing. So the simple fact of the matter is if I wrote something that I thought was funny as I was writing it, later on when I have the privilege of reading it with some distance, chances are I will probably still find it funny. There's that marketing term of eating your own dog food. Like, you have to believe in the stuff that you do more than anybody else. I will occasionally reread my stuff. I was like, well, it's here. And I'll be like, oh, yeah, no, he actually knows what he's doing. I hardly believe he's me.
It's so fun. So for anybody who hasn't already seen this book online or in a bookstore, what's it about?
It's The Moon Turns to Cheese, and for an entire lunar cycle, the world has to deal with it. And that's pretty much it. And then every chapter is a new day in the lunar cycle, and nearly all the chapters have different protagonists from all walks of life. And that was important for me to do because, the moon shines for us all. And so I wanted to make sure that I had the point of view from people from, you know, the White House on down.
Were you hangry when you came up with this idea?
No, I wasn't. The thing about it was so many of my books are like looking at things that are tropes, right? And I remember being a kid and people told me, you know, the moon is made out of cheese. And I'm like, what? And so there are very few people who have not heard the idea of the moon being turned to cheese. And I'm like, okay, what if the moon does turn to cheese? How do we deal with it? And that's kind of a fun thing for me, is to take something that is basically either a trope or a joke or just something that people are like, yeah, okay, whatever, and really dig into it and find an actual story and actual humor and actual pathos in it. And it's a thing that I don't think anybody else says. When I told people, they were like, what's the next book? I'm like, The Moon Turns to Cheese. And they're like, yeah, that's you. Right? Like, nobody else would do that. Nobody's stupid enough to do that, but I am. And as a result, I mean, I'm actually really, really happy with this book because I have people come up to me and be like, I was not expecting to cry about a moon turning to cheese and you made me cry and I don't like you anymore. And I'm like, yes.
I was going to say, do you revel in making people cry?
I do. Oh, I do. I do. Well, no, you know, the thing is that as a writer, you want the stuff that you're doing to affect people. You want them to cry when you want them to cry. You want them to laugh when you want them to laugh. You want to take them on an emotional journey, even if, again, the premise is silly. It's like, yes, the premise is silly, but the people who have to deal with it are going to deal with it in realistic ways, and sometimes people are going to cry.
That's one thing that really stood out with this is the humanity in the absurd.
Yeah.
So how do you focus in on the humanity while still balancing the science part of the science fiction and the humor and just making sure it still has a heart?
Well, I mean, the thing is, people are people, right? And science fiction has traditionally gotten a kind of bad rap of not being real good with human characters. Like, fantastic ideas, but the characters can be a little cardboard. And I think in the last 20 years in particular, and that has been changing. We've had an influx of so many new writers who are actually just really facile and really talented writers, that characters are now just really vibrant and really, really, really good. And for me, that has always been a guiding principle. You can have the coolest idea, but if you don't have characters that people care about, if you don't have a story, their story is not interesting, then it doesn't matter how cool your idea is, it's still going to be a cardboard sort of story. So for me, it always starts with the characters. And like I said, it's easy to take a farcical idea and, you know, try to be farcical about it. It's more difficult to take what is essentially a farcical idea and actually apply it to people who would have real lives, where, you know, yes, the moon has turned to cheese, but you also have to take out the trash. Also, your dog is sick and you have to take it to the vet. You know, you still go on with your life. And how that balance of, you know, as you said, taking the absurd, the moon has turned to cheese, and the real, and now because the moon has turned to cheese, my life has been kind of upended, and now what? How do I deal with it? The fun is in finding that balance and to making it work. And the answer is you just do it, and if it's not working, you tweak it or you throw it out and you start again, and you find a way to make it work.
Do you have a favorite perspective from this book?
There is a chapter which is a Slack chat between a group of friends who are going to get together for, there was an eclipse party in the book, and they all start like dropping the eclipse party because the end of the world is coming, you know, the moon has turned to cheese, all that sort of stuff, and the person who organized the party is just angry, and they're having that conversation in a Slack channel and discovering why he's so angry that people are not going to come to his party. I mean, it's always a bummer when people come to your party, but he's like really upset, and that whole thing delivered in Slack channel form, that's kind of my favorite one, because you get to, you know, you get to have the real emotions, but you also get to have the real emotions in a Slack channel. And that's kind of fun, too.
That's a very fun, like the interstitials with like the Reddit and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
They're very fun
right.
additions.
Well, and that's also where the journalism comes in again, because I did a lot of fake articles, you know, from fake New York Times, fake Washington Post, fake Chicago Tribune, right?
Super fun.
Super fun. Super fun. Super fun.
So this book begs the question, what's your favorite kind of cheese?
I have recently been making a stand for a type of cheese that I feel is much maligned and underappreciated, and it is American cheese. And I will tell you why. Well, first off, you know, people are like, well, you know, it's not really cheese, it's cheese product, which is true. It's got emulsifiers in it and everything else like that. But look, here's the thing. American cheese, maybe it's a little bland, right? Maybe it's not your first choice of, like, cheese if you're, like, trying to impress people. But if you've got a cheeseburger or if you've got mac and cheese and you need that sort of creamy, melty, mouthfeel thing that you can only get from a cheese food product that is emulsified so it won't break and turn into an oily, fatty disaster when you put it on something, then American cheese is your go-to friend. It doesn't claim to be the best cheese in the world. It just has a very specific job that it does very, very well. And when they ask you, like, you know, what kind of cheese do you want on your cheeseburger? I'm like, something that won't turn into an oily mess, because cheddar turns into an oily mess. Parmesan turns into, it breaks. It turns into runny oil and weird milk residue. American cheese melts without complaint, is happy to do it, is happy to make your gooey experience something pleasurable. And I think that matters. And I think people don't appreciate American cheese for what it is and what it can do. So next time you hear someone trash on American cheese, be like, excuse me, sir, ma'am, or whomever, I think you're wrong. and there's no other cheese you want on that cheeseburger, do you?
Justice for American cheese.
Justice for American cheese.
Oh, I love it so much. That was not what I was expecting.
No, no, nobody does. Nobody expects American cheese. But that's my whole point, is like, you know, let's look at the thing that does the thing and does it exactly how you want the thing to happen.
But also, you wouldn't expect people wouldn't expect you to show up in a shirt that says Alpha Male in pink puffy letters.
I mean, this is my life. This is who I am. I love this shirt because, of course, it is that, again, the reversal of expectation. And that's kind of my stock and trade at this point. Also, it's a great shirt.
It is so much fun. I giggled so hard.
Yes.
When I first saw it. I walked by your signing and I was like, oh, there it is.
There it is. It's become a kind of a famous shirt. Like, I put it on and I put it on the internet. It immediately went viral. And it was 90% people like, this is an amazing shirt and I love everything about it. And 10% was a bunch of dudes being like, oh, no, that's not what being an alpha male is about at all. Ah! And you're just like, bless you. Bless you, sir. I hope therapy one day will help.
True that.
True that.
What has helped you maintain such a long career in the creative space?
Luck actually had a lot to do with it. And people hate it when I say that. It's like, yeah, I mean, I got lucky. And people are like, no, you're good at what you do. And I'm like, no, I am very good at what I do. But my first book came out. It came out on January 1st of 2005, and I want you to think about what that means. It means that my publisher, who, by the way, I love, and they're wonderful people, said to themselves, let's put out a book after the largest commercial season in the year on a day where all the stores are closed, right? So let's just say the cards were not, you know, in the favor of this book when it was starting off. And yet it became a success in a way that nobody was expecting. I got lucky. It was in the right place at the right time with the right storyline, and people just ate it up. And ever since then, the whole thing is just keep doing the thing, right? On that basis of luck, I've been able to roll it on to other things. And there have been other times where I got lucky. Red Shirts was a lucky break, right? Starter Villain, which was a book that came out just before When the Moon Hit Your Eye.
And a Barnes & Noble pick of the month.
And a Barnes & Noble pick of the month. Such a good choice. Thank you.
We sold many.
Yes, you sold many. And part of the luck for that was that cover. That cover with a business cat in a business oil painting, I think probably sold 10 to 15% more simply because people are like, there's a cat on that cover and I need it.
We literally have a table right now and that's our anchor title and it's books with cats on the cover.
Right. That's exactly right. And the thing is, if it had had a different cover, then things would have been, that would have been different. I got lucky with that cover. Again, luck is the residue of preparation, right? If you have a moment where things go your way and you're able to sort of capitalize on it, then it becomes lucky as opposed to that one weird thing that happened to you. But it is luck. I mean, there are other writers who write just as well as me who have not had the careers that I have had, not because they're not doing the work, not because they didn't have the effort, not because the books aren't good, because they are, but for whatever reason, the books just didn't hit. And so luck is a lot of it. Luck and the acknowledgement that, yes, do put out a book a year. Make sure there's always something new. Kind of try to make them interesting. And in my particular case, make them so that when someone goes, well, I don't really read a lot of science fiction and fantasy, so I don't know where to begin, booksellers can be like, oh, but here's Old Man's War, or oh, here's Red Shirts, or oh, here's Starter Villain. It's something you can give to someone who hasn't read science fiction fantasy before, and they don't feel it's so removed from their what they ordinarily read that they feel lost and out and lost in space, so to speak.
You talked a little bit about in TJ's panel about your first advance and right. How small it was.
Yeah.
And now the
$6,500.
Yeah.
Wow.
To now having a multi-million-dollar deal with
sure.
Tor.
Sure.
Like, what's it like for you to see your growth in that way? Like, huge growth.
I mean, it was nice. I mean, I like being paid well for the things that I do. But one of the things that was really important to me, like when I was starting off, right, and I got that $6,500 advance, which is not a lot. But the thing was, for me at the time, it was less about the money and more about the fact of, oh, I get to have this novel. When I started writing novels, I was already an established writer. I had been a journalist for many years. I was a fairly successful freelance writer and consultant. And I had written nonfiction books. So I had like three or four books that had come up before Old Man's War came out, and they're all nonfiction. So I was in a place where money was not a particular concern. And that, again, was also lucky because I could say $6,500 and not be like, well, I can't live on $6,500, and more of, oh, $6,500 is okay, and we'll see where this goes. So the gist of it is I was in a very fortunate position to be like, okay, let's see where this goes. Not every writer, and it's really important to stress this, is in the same fortunate position where they're like, that the relatively paltry sum that you get as a first-time novelist isn't going to be an imposition to them. So in that, I got lucky. Now, what I can say is, as my advances advanced, they always kept in line to with what I was selling. So I don't feel like there's any point where Tor was like giving me more money than I deserved or trying to give me less money than I should get. It's always been a pretty good relationship there. But it has been kind of weird to all of a sudden go to recognize that, no, this is my job now, that I am a full-time novelist. And when that first book sale happened, I remember saying to Chrissy, my wife, I'm like, just so you know, no one ever makes money being a novelist. You know, here's what the advances generally are. They're usually low five figures. And maybe I will do a novel every 2 or 3 years and it will come out. And I might go to a convention and people will be like, oh, yeah, you're that guy who wrote that thing. Yeah, okay. But meanwhile, I will keep my day job of freelancing and consulting. So the fact that at a certain point, I was like, no, it makes no sense to be doing anything else but writing novels because they are paying me much more than I would get otherwise, was a really weird moment for me and entirely unexpected. Like I said, I started in journalism. I assumed I would be a journalist forever.
Don't we all?
Don't we all? And then
reality hits.
And then reality hits. So I tell people I'm an accidental journalist people who are readers are like, well, that's cool. And people who are writers are like, I'm going to push you out of a window now.
What can we be looking for next from you?
Well, the next novel actually comes out this year as well. It's on September of 16th, I believe. It is called The Shattering Peace, and it is the 7th book in the Old Man's War series. And it's been 10 years since the last book in the series. And this year is also the 20th anniversary of the first book of the series coming out. So we thought that this would be an opportune time to go back into the universe and find out what's going on there. So that's the next thing. And then after that, we'll find out.
Ooh, suspense.
Yes.
The last question we always ask.
Okay.
Because this is literary hype, what books are you hyped about right now?
The book that I have most recently read is actually T.J. Klune's latest book, and it was wonderful. And the book before that I read was Mary Robinette's latest book, which is called The Martian Contingency. And both of those were because I was going to be doing events with them, and I'm like, oh, I need to catch up with what they're doing. And the good news is I get to hang out with really, really impressive writers. So both of those books have been just a delight to read. So those are the two things that I've been reading the most recently, and it's a great time to be reading science fiction and fantasy in general. So much good stuff out there. So when you go to your local bookstore, she's, you know, you will be able to choose from many, many fine books. And please buy several.
Several. It could be drugs.
Right.
Spend your money on books, not
drugs. Right. Yeah, books, not drugs. Exactly.
Better
for your brain.
Exactly. So much better. So much better for the world.
So much better for the world.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to talk to Literary Hype about your brand new book, When the Moon Hits Your Eye.
Thank you. It was a delight to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to John for taking time out of his very busy CTV2 schedule to talk all about his book, When the Moon Hits Your Eye, and just writing in general, and just being a goofy human being. I had so much fun. I hope he did too. It was a grand old time. If you'd like to get your hands on a copy of When the Moon Hits Your Eye or any of John's other books, the links to do so are down in the show notes for you, as well as where to find him on social media. If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to like this video, subscribe to the Literary Hype YouTube channel, and click that little bell so you get notifications every time I post a video. Thanks for watching. I'll see you next time.